Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this session on industry funds, the next demutualisations, which will be presented by Colin Yellowlees. Just by way of introduction, Colin is RGA Australia's Chief Pricing Actuary. He's more than 20 years of experience in life insurance in the UK and Australia, working in both individual and group business, experience covering pricing, valuation, capital management, mergers and acquisitions and reinsurance. He's been actively involved in the actuarial profession in Australia, having been a member of a number of committees, including the Life Insurance Wealth Management Practice Committee, convener of the Product Development Subcommittee, and joint author of the IBNR discussion note. He's also been active in the industry looking at how to address emerging issues in the group risk space, and has presented various topics on this subject. So over to Cole. We'll have some questions at the end.
All right, let's get this show on the road. Click. Right, thanks for all coming today. I assume those at the back are probably wanting to nod off to sleep after lunch. There's plenty of room at the front, but I hope you enjoy the presentation anyway. So first, what I'm going to cover today is just a little bit about the motivation of doing this in the first place. I'll talk a bit about the past in terms of history of industry funds and superannuation. I'll talk about the present and what's going to happen in the near future or potentially happen in the near future. And I'll talk about sort of what the implications are this is for industry funds and the superannuation industry. But first, disclaimer, I'm a life insurance actuary. I'm not a superannuation actuary. I'm not a lawyer. So apologies if some of these views might seem a little bit naive to those who spend more time working in superannuation. Also part of the, I guess, motivation was really thinking about sort of how the broader environment sort of will impact in the area that I'm working in life insurance, because there will be a lot of implications for life insurance. So over sort of last 20 years, there's actually been a lot of demutualisations within Australia. The late 90s saw a lot of demutualisations of life companies with the likes of AMP, MLC, sort of National Mutual and Colonial demutualising during that period. And the main motivation of this was really to improve access to capital for increased capital requirements, et cetera, and get access to those capital markets. Throughout the 90s and 2000s, we had demutualisations of a large number of building societies and a few friendly societies in there as well. And some of these sort of have turned into well-known names today, with the likes of St George Bank and IOOF being two. The most recent wave of demutualisations have been health funds, NIB, MBF, for example, in the late 2000s. So they've demutualised recently. And then two other prominent ones are NRMA in 2000 and the Australian Stock Exchange in 1998. So it's certainly nothing new. There's been similar experience in the UK with the demutualisation of life offices and building societies. So first, now the topic refers to demutualisations, but mutuals are really sort of organisations which are owned by members. So there was an error in the name. So I've changed it to Industry Funds of the Next Generation, because the industry funds are jointly owned by employer groups and unions. They're not owned by the members. So a bit of history. We have to go back to 1978, when Lucrif was set up by the Federated Storemen and Packers Union. It was the very first industry fund established. So Lucrif stands for Labour Union Cooperative Retirement Fund. And the unions had the idea of setting up a superannuation fund for their members, and they actually approached employers to join the trustee board. And this really established the principle of equal representation all the way back then. You have to wait till 1984 before the creation of many of the industry funds of today. So CBUS's predecessors, BUS and AUST, were really the start of all that. And then the formation of industry funds really accelerated during 85 and 86 with the introduction of the 3% employer superannuation contribution, which at that time covered about 40% of the total workforce. And this really came about largely through the negotiation between the ACTU and the Hawke government and building superannuation into employment agreements. Coverage increased from about 32% to 68% by 1991 in the private sector. The public sector was much better covered by that stage. Fast forward to 92, and things really started moving. 92 saw the introduction of the superannuation guarantee, and contributions were required to be increased from 3% to 9% by 2002. And overall coverage was then gradually increased to about over 70% of the workforce. Skip to 2005, and we have the introduction of the first choice of fund legislation, which saw only about 60% of members actually able to elect which superannuation fund they can go to, where they can put their super. Many of those outside the superannuation industry don't realise that choice of fund's not available to all members yet. It's still not available to the members who are within enterprise bargaining agreements, for example, if their employer doesn't give them the choice. And over the past 10 years, changes are continually made especially around tax regulation and various limits. But probably the key elements of today's system were set up from about 2005. So the industry today, there's more than $2 trillion worth of assets invested in superannuation funds. Almost a quarter of this is in industry funds itself. This chart does show SMSFs, which are a very rapidly growing area of the superannuation asset area. And if you pull those out, then the proportion held by industry funds is certainly a very large proportion. We see their presence almost everywhere. You have Host Plus sponsoring the Melbourne Storm. You have Australian Super sort of sponsoring The Voice. You have Sun Super sponsoring an evening with Oprah, for example. And there's certainly a lot of press advertising. So what's an industry fund? Firstly, and principally, they're a not-for-profit organisation set up between employees and employers. Traditionally, they've been aligned to a particular industry. They've had equal representation on their board between employers and employees. And certainly in the past, they weren't public offer, so they were restricted to various members who were on agreements listed in various awards or enterprise bargaining agreements. That's changed. Many funds now are public offer, so they can accept any member. They're looking outside their traditional industry as well for new members. So they are certainly broadening their reach. Looking at the various funds that are around, there is a very wide distribution of industry fund membership, but it is dominated by six or seven of them who have the vast majority of members. They're all well-known and recognised names. So that shows it certainly by number of accounts. If you look at it by funds under administration, again, you see it again dominated by the largest seven funds with a bit of variation in there. There are a lot of smaller funds, and they generally focused on particular industries and may still not be public offer. So what are the strengths of an industry fund? So first is they've got a privileged position in the superannuation industry where they dominate the awards and named on many of the EBAs. Only a small proportion of members actually make a choice, which means that industry funds automatically get the contribution of the majority of members. Second, it's a good story on so many levels. We've all seen the example of the Compare the Pair ad, which is very, very successful, to the extent that some outside industry funds actually challenged the industry fund's ability to do this sort of advertising. However, it's been established that they are sort of entitled to advertising. And I think it's also particularly relevant, I guess, with the recent negative press around bank and insurance companies, where some of the press are placing the blame at sort of they're putting profit before customers. So it is a good story for industry funds. Tying strongly into this is that they do promote themselves as such. So often when you receive correspondence, Normally within the first one or two sentences, it will always say run only to profit members. There's other sort of intangible benefits with being an industry fund. I guess in my experience of dealing with them, most of the employees take very special pride and satisfaction of being motivated to do the best of their members, and not having to strive to continually maximise shareholder value. And they're generally managed for the longer term as well, rather than sort of continually trying to maximise profits on a quarterly basis. Current weaknesses. As an industry fund, as a superannuation fund, that's about all it can do under the sole purpose test. They can provide sort of limited ancillary services like insurance, etc., with the core provision of superannuation. Some of the things they can do are things like promotion and advertising and sponsorship, and provision of some advice like intra-fund advice, etc. They don't have access to capital through the capital markets, so in terms of investment and growth, this is a big inhibitor for them. And lastly, I think they've been relatively poor at tailoring their offering to the retail market. If you look at master trust type structures, they're very good at providing specific sort of products for individual corporates. This is something that a lot of industry funds are still struggling to do, with providing a minimum amount of tailoring for their members. So what's changing? So now we get into the present. So there's a lot going on. So I've really broken this up into three themes. I'm going to talk about what's happening in the regulatory environment, the impact of technology, and also sort of demographics. So these are certainly three forces which are will have a big impact on the industry funds. Also, it's worth pointing out that regulatory-wise, there will be a lot of uncertainty going forward. We don't know which government will be in place for the later half of this year, so that could have a big impact on this discussion. But certainly there are changes and there are external pressures. If we go to the FSI recommendations, so I guess through a lot of the rest of this presentation, I'm assuming that the FSI recommendations actually get implemented. So I'll go through each of those and talk about how it impact on industry funds. So the first one, just quickly through here, and I'll go through in some more detail. So recommendations were improving efficiency during accumulation phase, the retirement phase of superannuation, extending choice of fund, and improving the governance of superannuation funds. So firstly, onto choice of fund. So as I said previously, choice of fund is only available to about 60% of members. Those who sit in collective agreements at the moment may or may not have choice of fund. It's up to the individual employer. However, there's now legislation drafted by the government to extend choice of fund almost universally to those in collective agreements as well. So this, for those who don't have choice at the moment, this will certainly open them up to competition. So that was one of the recommendations of the FSI, which is already in legislation. Well, it was before Parliament previously. Default fund, as I said, the majority of default funds on awards at the moment are industry funds, and one of the recommendations of FSI was to really open this up to competition. So really the scope of it was develop alternate models for a formal competitive process of allocating default fund members to products. I guess the FSI found the superannuation system was not operationally efficient due to lack of price-based competition, so competition on fees in a sector, and that potential benefits of scale were not actually being realised. If you look over a number of years, there's been very little reduction in the actual fees that members are paying, even though funds under management have been growing very rapidly. So the FSI recommended a review of the competitiveness and efficiency of the superannuation system to be undertaken by the Productivity Commission. This review is now underway, and they've already released an initial report on the efficiency and competitiveness of the sector, and that was released in March. So the current role of the Fair Work Commission for default funds will likely disappear, because at the moment they decide which funds go on which awards, and it will possibly be replaced by a tender process. So the timetable for that is up on the screen. So you're really looking at, I guess, implementation about 2019-2020. But really the main aim is to introduce proper consumer-driven competition. If we look at what the impact this might have on industry funds, here I've segmented really where funds sit for retail funds and industry funds. Majority of funds and retail funds actually sit in choice products at the moment, with a small portion sitting in MySuper products. However, if you look at industry funds, it's really the other way around. Majority of their funds actually sit in MySuper products, with a limited, lesser amount sitting in choice. So it's really, in terms of, you think, what's really up for grabs, you're really looking at that MySuper portion of industry funds would largely be where a lot of the default members are going. It wasn't so much an FSR recommendation, but there will certainly be a lot happening on account consolidation if there is increased competition and increased awareness. There's somewhere between 25 and 30 million superannuation accounts in Australia. On average, people hold sort of close to two accounts. This is data from the ATO, which shows the proportion of members holding how many accounts. So 45% of Australians have more than one superannuation account. I mean, there's sometimes good reasons for that, but a lot of these are duplicate accounts. So this is really what potential. So if there's sort of further account consolidation, then the number of accounts could reduce dramatically. Next is on governance. So this was another FSI recommendation, and this was to have at least one third of a trustee board made up of independent directors. Many of the industry funds have argued against this, believing that the current system is working. However, there's already legislation drafted to extend it to all boards, to have at least one third independent directors. Bringing independent directors onto boards will bring external views and make them more likely to challenge the status quo. And lastly, retirement incomes. There's a lot going on in retirement incomes and retirement planning at the moment. It's still very early days for SIPPers. I think that generally there is something in the industry, that generally this is something the industry is still learning to address, and there will be a lot of development in this area and for a while to come. So that's the regulatory environment. Then on to technology. Now, when I drafted this, I didn't actually use the word disruption anywhere, but there was a very good session before lunch, which covered disruption, and there's some common themes in here. So technology will play a big part of where superannuation goes. So throughout this conference, there's been lots of talks on big data, predictive modelling, driverless cars and more. But whichever way you look at it, this will have a massive impact on the superannuation industry. If you look back 20 years ago, sort of mobile phones were the size of bricks. The iPhones didn't really only come back out until 2007, which is not even 10 years ago. It's hard to imagine. So the impact of technology will only accelerate over the 20 years, and it will certainly be game-changing. In the middle here, I've shown a headline from a newspaper about trials to have babies fitted with microchips to be able to track them as they grew older. Although this was published on April Fool's Day, it was perhaps not so unbelievable at the time that sort of it actually fooled a lot of people and a lot of people fell for it. So these are the sorts of things that potentially we've got in our future. But there's a lot of technology that we need to pay attention to. First of these is blockchain. So it's a technology which underlies Bitcoin, for example. So it'll have far-reaching implications. It'll allow almost real-time financial transactions at minimal cost. And today this is something the banks, amongst many, are investing large amounts of money in. Implementing this technology will go a long way to reducing costs across the super industry and allow accounts to transfer much more readily, in my view. We've got robo-advice as well. We've got Arnie up there. So referring more to just setting investment strategy, for example, so this is really more about providing full advice to members. and ultimately meet the requirements and get the approval of ASIC. So these two technologies combined, if implemented, will allow a large part of the current unserviced market access to advice. So traditionally, advice has really been only used by the higher net worth individuals, and this will make it accessible to a lot more people. The others that I've listed are more general developments that go beyond super, and there's been plenty of discussion of these over the past 2 days. And the presentation by Paul and Kenny previously was very good. So that's technology. So demographics. Population is ageing, and with this comes the greater need for specialist advice and the need to develop the comprehensive retirement solutions. We've heard a lot about this yesterday at the ageing seminar. So there'll be a lot of investment needing to go into that in terms of providing for retirement. Next, unions were core in the establishment of industry funds and played a significant role in the development of the super industry in general. However, membership of unions have been dropping over the past 20 years. If you go back to when super was originally set up as it is, early 90s, there was 25-30% membership of unions. Now it's down to about 10%, and here I'm referring to the private sector, which is where the industry funds play. Lastly, today's workforce is rapidly changing. Many people are moving employers more often than previously. CSIRO recently published a report that projected up to 44% of today's jobs are under threat in the next 20 years, so that's a massive change. Lots of people will be changing occupations and industries. And this means that some of the industry-specific industry funds may end up with declining membership. So what does this all mean? As I said, this assumes that a lot of the FSI recommendations will go through. But with the opening up of competition on default funds, we're likely to see much stronger fee-based competition than we have before. Some believe that a target of fees close to about 0.5% is probably a reasonable target. Here's a chart from a report by the Grattan Institute, which shows the breakup of fees by various types of fund. You can see that the lowest fee superannuation funds are both the public sector, industry public sector and corporate ones, with the retail fees being much, much higher than those. And I'd recommend reading the Grattan Institute report, which came out last year. If we break this up a little bit further, so this has fees on the left-hand side, on the y-axis, and expenses on the x-axis, and the size of the circle represent the various sizes of the super funds. You can see that all the industry funds are clustered here, and the retail funds are actually up here. But certainly one thing that's worth noticing is their expenses aren't any more if you look at, say, these funds. These are a little bit higher. But if you look at expenses themselves, they're not that much higher or very similar to industry funds. It's their fees that at the moment they're much higher. Fee-based competition will have a big impact on that picture. Why commercialise rather than... why should an industry fund commercialise then if they've got a privileged position today? I guess a lot of it's changing. So they really lose their privileged default fund position. But if they do commercialise, they certainly lose a lot of their current strengths. All they're really left with at the moment would potentially be lower fees. But the benefits of, I guess, that has to be weighed up against the benefits of commercialising. So the access to capital and being able to diversify with their current barrier of the sole purpose test. So one scenario that could play out is first FSI recommendations will get implemented. They'll lose their privileged position as default funds through an open tender process. As a result of that, retail funds will compete more strongly on fees and other services, This, along with the introduction of things like robo-advice and blockchain, will allow them to, will make members a lot more mobile as well. A lot of small industry funds will need to reconsider their viability and merge with larger funds, and not necessarily an industry fund. And I guess the larger industry funds will discover they can no longer compete on fees and are unable to provide the same breadth of services that full financial service companies can. And the result is industry funds, I guess, will consider to commercialise or demutualise. Just a quick slide on who actually owns and controls the industry funds then. So here are some of the largest ones listed again. And as I said, there are 50-50 ownership arrangement between employer groups and employee and unions. So if you take Australian Super for an example, it's jointly owned by the Australian Industry Group and the ACTU. It currently doesn't have any independent representation on its board. And you see a few in there, so that's who owns the industry funds. Now, this has already happened to a certain to one fund. So LESF, which is the Law Employees Superannuation Fund, based in Queensland, small industry fund, about 4,000 members, about $90 million in assets. So it actually transferred its trusteeship across from one trustee to another in August 2013 and actually went from not-for-profit to a for-profit organisation. So this went to a commercial trustee, a commercial financial organisation. So, and quoted in their report, LESF needs greater resources and promotion to sustain and improve member benefits over the longer term. So this is trustee is actually considering the future of their superannuation fund, and more of this will happen. Talking about potential valuations, if they do demutualise, what would be the what would the potential valuations be? I've put down three peers on here. So the North Platform was valued at about 3% of funds under administration at the time of its when it was sold. Current IOOF market caps are about 2% of funds under administration. And the BT Investment Management has a market cap of about 3.5% of funds under management. So that's sort of potential peers you could look at valuations for. If you look at the difference, I guess, between the super fund fees between retail funds and industry funds, on the MySuperChoice is about 30 basis points difference. So industry funds could potentially charge 30% more and still compete with retail funds. And if you look at Choice, it's a much wider gap between industry funds and retails with about 90 basis points difference in fees. So very simplistically, you get about 3% of funds under management for an industry fund if you use a price earnings multiple of about 15%. So charting the potential valuations, total industry fund market would be worth about $13 billion in market cap at a 3% of funds under administration valuation, which only really equates to a little bit over $1,000 per member. So, it's not all that much when you're thinking about it in terms of members. So, in concluding, I guess there's a few themes in here. So, retail funds and industry funds will compete much more directly for customers, and fee-based competition will compete, and those members will be more mobile. And industry funds may struggle to provide the same breadth of services. So we've got a little graphic up here. So industry funds really sit in this space at the moment with low fees and sort of their position within distribution. Retail funds really sit up here with their product breadth at the moment. And I guess in the future, to survive, you're really going to need to be in the middle here. To actually sort of win the customer and grow and prosper. So that's the conclusion of my talk. So thank you very much, and I can take questions. Or open the floor up for a broader discussion between people who are here. Anyway.
Thanks, Cole. All right, we'll open the floor up to questions. Let me kick off with one. Cole, what do you think that industry funds will gain more or then they will lose in terms of demutualising?
I mean, I personally would hate to see industry funds demutualise. I mean, I think they're a great vehicle today, and I think they've done an excellent job at what they're meant to do. I haven't talked about timeframes here, I guess, but I don't think any of this will happen in the next probably 10 years, but certainly between 10 and 20. But I think the biggest barrier for industry funds is their ability to provide sort of full service and full suite of financial products to their members. To a certain extent, it depends whether they really find a place on aggregators, for example, and whether they can really tap into the advice market without having to provide the services themselves. I mean, certainly for industry funds, there's not, I guess, a big estate sitting there at the moment. They've even had to build up some capital reserves recently, or some of them have. There are some interesting issues around if you have a profit share, for example, on insurance premiums. Some of the superannuation industry funds don't actually like that, even though you're giving them money, because they don't know how to distribute it to members and don't know what to do with it. So that provides interesting issues.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that was a really interesting paper, and as somebody outside of the industry, I think you've captured well the main strengths that we in the industry, the main weaknesses and strengths that we in the industry grapple with. And I should say that I sit on the board of the AIST, which is the peak lobby group for the industry. And I think one of the issues that not only mutual funds face, but also funds like AMP, is the big issue around when you don't have the banking relationship with the customer, will they tolerate not having, you know, at one click of their fingers, their super balance next to their bank balance? And my suspicion is that the days of our members tolerating that are very numbered. And so the real challenge for those who are not their banking provider to their customer is going to be those aggregation platforms or the technology solutions that enable it, which of course will require both some very clever technology but also large capital reserves. So I think that's a big challenge. And I just had a question. You said that industry funds don't need to merge with other industry funds. What kind of players do you see them merging with? Are you talking about master trusts or other kinds of organisations?
I guess, well, the example I showed, and it's probably mostly relevant for the smaller funds. The example I showed with LESF, they went to a professional trustee or a trustee services company. They went to a company called Diversa, which is a sort of small growing company, but they're the trustee for a number of funds, including the Transport Industry Super Fund as well, even though that's still a not-for-profit fund. So I guess I'm thinking about the likes of, I guess, IOOF, which is a similar history as well, so that sort of master trust. I don't know whether that's something that the banks, for example, would be interested in doing in terms of sweeping up smaller industry funds. But it will certainly more happen in the smaller industry fund space where they question their sustainability.
Hey, Colin. It's Jenny Gibbs from AIA. You mentioned about access to capital, and then a few slides later you talk about industry funds accumulating capital for profit share, not wanting that. So if they have access to capital, what would they use it for? And then my second question is, do you see this as a precursor to more industry funds demutualising and then owning a life insurance company and a licence?
I guess in terms of your first question, I guess industry funds to survive will need to branch out from just superannuation, and that will, I guess the need, that need is more driving having to access capital to actually build those capabilities, etc. Because there will be a large amount of investment required, I guess, to move. And that will be really forced upon them by, I guess, competition from those who can offer full financial services to their members. What was your second question? There's one industry fund at the moment which is looking at setting up its own insurance company. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I guess the disadvantage there is running an insurance company really is a sort of a specialist skill. And it's not the most capital efficient way to just run an insurance company just to do group risk. You lack some of the diversification benefits with various other, like investment risk, for example. So it wouldn't necessarily be the most efficient way. A lot of the industry funds are actually moving towards insourcing a lot of their functions. Certainly the larger ones now will do their own investment management. And there's others which insource a lot of what they do. I would think that they would continue to outsource insurance for a while to come, even if they did commercialise.
John Wilkinson, looking at your second point, fee-based competition will increase. How will that affect group life? Because they've had to put their premiums up dramatically, I know, because of APRA. But if they're going to be fee-based competition, how are they going to handle that one?
In terms of group insurance premiums, I don't think it will have a big impact on that. I guess those that have previously sort of shied away from profit shares will opt for profit shares because they'll be able to do something with the premiums that are returned. So I don't think there'll be a big impact. There will be impacts on insurance, though. There'll probably be a couple. First, I see members being a lot more mobile. So this will mean that certainly during the initial stages of the competition, there'll be a much bigger turnover in your membership. So you should see the demographics changing very rapidly. There'll also be a lot of pressure on cross-subsidies within insurance rates as well. So I think that will be a big factor. If you look at some superannuation funds compared to others, they've got very different cross-subsidies between, say, male and female, for example. So some funds have male and female separate rates. Some have unisex rates. So you'll all get females moving to funds which have female rates so they can access cheaper rates. So there'll be a lot of movement based on insurance because it is a large component of your fees. So I think there is that aspect. But I think overall the margins on group life won't be pressured too much. Probably one of the other things worth pointing out and be interested to get someone's view on is if there's fee-based competition, you can see who it potentially got the biggest impact on. So the retail funds whose fees are actually much, much higher at the moment, if they do compete based on fees, they'll actually have to move their fees an awful lot. So that's obviously a decision that they'll actually have to make, whether they actually want to squeeze those margins or not. So that's sort of an interesting issue from the other side as well, not just industry funds.
Going for time. What do you see, Cole, as the key implications for the retail funds then, given these dynamics?
Well, I guess it's really up on that slide. So whilst the retail funds will be able to compete to be placed on awards, for example, and be the default fund, to do so, they're actually going to have to bring down their fees considerably to be actually to achieve that objective of being on the default fund. So I think in general it's probably going to be good for members of superannuation funds if true fee-based competition is brought in. You could see some substantial fees being brought in. I mean, it should be noted also that a lot of those high fees are on choice funds. They're not on necessarily on my super funds. So certainly there's a much smaller differential between retail funds and industry funds if you look at just straight my super.
Any other questions from the floor at the moment? Who do you see as the, I suppose, key winners out of this, from a customer perspective, the funds, the...
I guess the members will be the key winners. I mean, really what you've got here is an intersection of sort of technological developments at the same time as sort of introduce opening it up to fee-based competition. I don't think you could probably have... It'd be very hard, I think, to have true competition without the sort of the technological enablers. I mean, at the moment, most members are very, very disengaged. So there's very little movement between industry funds or super funds. But I guess with sort of the move to being able to provide advice to a much broader spectrum of the community, then members will certainly become a lot more mobile. So I think the winners will definitely be the members.
Hi, Ronald from Tao. You haven't been in super for a while, and just wonder if anyone in the audience or Cole, you have a view on the impact of MySuper and the fact that consumers, accelerated growth in the in SMSF. So would the industry fund, or particularly all those retail, stay with my choice? Are they really going to get anywhere, given like members or consumers, they actually prefer to do it all themselves? And, the growth is really in SMSF. So the those who aren't making a choice, they're actually happily sitting under my super with no choice, and they don't feel they need the financial services either.
So a couple of things there. I mean, if you look at industry funds, they really do have quite low account balances at the moment, on average. So sort of order of 50-50. Well, I'm not sure what the numbers are, but they are low, and they're much lower than retail funds. And industry funds, to a certain extent, struggle to retain the higher account balances because they do go to retail funds where they can get buy a retail insurance product, for example, within the Master Trust. Or they go to SMSFs. And that's one of the reasons why, I guess, industry funds will need to try and somehow diversify their product offering to others to be able to retain those members who, as they grow their account balance, will want to move to somewhere where they can see their bank balance and their super fund online at the same time, where they can sort of get tailored retail products, et cetera, that fit their needs. So... certainly one of the objectives of industry funds is to try and retain those larger account balances, and they need to search for ways to do that. Otherwise, they will suffer from continually having low account balances, and that's the sort of position where they will struggle on fees.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I think we're just about out of time, so if you can just join me in thanking Cole for his presentation today.